Good afternoon and welcome to High Notes in week 5 of our 2016 summer season. I'm Alan Fletcher, president of the Aspen Music Festival and School. It is a great thrill and pleasure and honor to be joined on stage here in the PEPCA Auditorium by William Bolcom. Bill is simultaneously one of the most admired, respected, and beloved of living composers, and believe me, those three things don't always go together. But winner of the Pulitzer Prize, the National Medal of Arts. One source I looked at said 2 Grammys, but his great Songs of Innocence and Experience won 4 Grammys all by itself, so I don't know what the correct...
One of them went for me, and 2 went to the choral director.
Oh, okay. Musical America named him Composer of the Year in 2007. He has a very distinguished teaching career. Some leading lights of younger composers in America were his students. He was at Ann Arbor for 35 years on the faculty. Started out with Darius Milhaud, who of course had a great history here in Aspen, and also Olivier Messiaen, who came to Aspen.
Actually, that was my first meeting with Darius Milhaud, and we became great friends. He asked me to come to the Paris Conservatoire in another year, which I did. I studied with him there for a year.
Fantastic. So I think we'll get a little later to some of your further history in Aspen. You've been here many times performing as well as, I think, working with composers.
I'm trying to think how many times I've been here. I mean, a lot of things I can't remember. And I have to ask our secretary, who knows everything. We can't breathe without Carol for some reason. She's absolutely marvelous. And, for example, many people have asked me, how many times has wedding been done? The same thing will be premiering for here tonight, I mean tomorrow. And I have to say I don't remember. I have to look and find out.
Oh, well, that's what you have
to do. And the same with my, you know, how many times I've been here. I'm not quite sure. I have to look.
Well, that's what a publisher is for, the question about a wedding. You said we, and so I thought I would just highlight that you've had a more than 40-year partnership with Joan Morris.
Who's right here, by the way.
Who is right with us here. We're thrilled about that. And they have been a tremendous force in the world of song, really, as some of the greatest recordings and performances worldwide tours. I think you are still touring as a duo.
No, actually, this last year, after 43 years of being on the road, we will still do concerts. For example, the next one, I think we're going to be doing one at a retirement home in the Ann Arbor area, but we're also going to appear at the Metropolitan Room in New York on the 29th of December. And there are odd ones here and there, but we used to have a fairly extensive career, sometimes 50 concerts a year. And then, meantime, I was also teaching at the University of Michigan, as was Joan after 81. And there were always things like operas for Lyric Opera Chicago. I did 3, of which this is the 3rd that we will be hearing, a wedding. So I was gone a lot, and I had a very understanding dean. In fact, the next dean was also understanding that if you're going to do opera, you're going to have to be away a lot. But composers are somebody you don't necessarily have to always see every week. During A View from the Bridge, which was my second opera there, our then dean, Paul Boylan, did a wonderful thing. He said, we will be willing to bankroll bringing your 6 students to Chicago and take care of their travel and their hotels. And Lyric Opera opened their arms to them. I was able by that time to be able to introduce them all over the whole opera house so they would have a good idea of what it was like to put on a professional opera in a next to, well, Lyric is next to Met in size. It's 35 versus 3,800 seats. And it's a very professional, wonderful house. Particularly in those years, they were quite involved with new music. Not, I think, so much since artist Kranich died, but I have to say my next opera, which is going to be premiering in March 11th, is at Minnesota Opera, which has made a specialty of new operas.
Fantastic. Well, I was going to get to that later, but let me jump on it now. You've written so far 3 full-length, evening-length operas, and all 3 for Lyric Opera in Chicago. McTeague, A View from the Bridge, and then A Wedding. And A Wedding is what we have on our program this week. It goes up tomorrow night at the Wheeler Opera House and is repeated on Saturday. We'll come back to A Wedding in depth later. So was it Artis Krennic, was that the reason, or Dennis Russell Davies, or both, that all three operas were for Chicago Lyric?
Actually, Dennis Russell Davies has premiered my most important pieces. You were mentioning the Songs of Innocence and of Experience, which was premiered by Dennis Russell Davies at all places. It's at the Stuttgart Opera, which he was running at the time in 1982. So the premiere was actually in Germany. The second performance was at the University of Washington by Gustav Meyer, who just recently left us. He's a wonderful man. And then after that it was done, I believe, at St. Louis was the next one. And I've talked to somebody who was there and saw both performances. And it's had something of a career. It was amazing, a piece of that size having been produced 16 or 17 times. Not so much since the new Naxos recording came out, after which, since it's all been put down, nobody particularly felt like they had to do it anymore. They could always listen to the recording. Leonard Slatkin went to the University of Michigan, and we were able to, and we also had named soloists, people like Christine Brewer and people of that caliber, coming, working with the students. And one of the things I remember very kindly was Leonard coming out in March. We actually did it in April in 2004. And he was at first quite concerned because it was going to be all student orchestra, but the University of Michigan is a fine school of music, as I'm sure you're aware. And he was absolutely bowled over. I remember we were doing the aria in one of the songs, their old songs, really, the Divine Image in the Songs of Innocence, which is sung by Joan. And there's an oboe solo at the end. And we were in rehearsal in March. And so Joan sang her part, and the oboe solos come in. And Leonard said, "I never do this, but that's some of the most beautiful oboe playing I've ever heard." And so it's the whole thing. People did not believe it was a school orchestra. I'll have to say that when I heard last night in rehearsal at the Wheeler Opera House, you would not guess that was a student orchestra either. And the performers are all very young, but my gosh, they're so polished. I have to say kudos to our fine director, David Schweitzer, who I'm finding a delightful person. I did not know him before that. But my librettist, who's working on, has done, what I think we're finished up now with the new opera at Minnesota called A Dinner at 8. And he sang his praises, and now I see how justified that is.
Now, you keep making me jump around, but let's just talk for 1 second about Songs of Innocence and Experience. It's a truly great work. It's about 3 hours. I think it gestated over many, many years. It changed. It's, of course, based on the poems by Blake, and it now involves a large orchestra, chorus. How many soloists?
Oh, about 15 solos. It can be done sometimes with more or sometimes with less, depending on what the production is, but it's about that. It takes an enormous amount of forces, however. Very large chorus, a madrigal group, which can either be 6 people or 18 or 20 or whatever they want to do, and also unusual instruments, things like guitar, rock band, harmonica. In the performance that you'll hear, if you buy the Naxos recording, one of the most marvelous harmonicists, a wonderful man named Tommy Morgan, performed in that. And if you ever saw Rawhide or any of those other things on television, or the harmonica solo in Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys, that is Tommy. And he is a fully trained musician, has a degree from the University of California, and I think maybe UCLA it was. Anyway, but a terrific guy, and so I wanted to use all those different instruments and different kinds of instrumentalists. He actually worked with a man named Peter Mad Cat Ruth doing the Shepherd, which how I ended up on so many different styles with so many different venues was these songs, each of them made me do them. I didn't say, gee, I'm going to be eclectic. But I kept myself, finding myself, here I come up to the Shepherd and I said, this is country and western. I can't be doing country and western. Ugh, I mean, don't even like country and western. But it was I do. I mean, if you want to talk about Jimmy Rogers or somebody. But anyway, it wouldn't go away. Mozart was supposed to have written a letter saying that he would have an idea and he'd try to bat it away. And if it kept coming back, he'd use it. And that's one of those things. So I finally, the whole piece was really kind of passively, me passively, being dragged to style and to ensemble and to venue and idiom by what was in the poem.
Well, that does link into my next question. You started out as a very gifted young composer. Seemingly influenced a lot by Boulez, Stockhausen, Berlioz.
Oh, well, that was actually a little further on in my life. There has now just been published my first 6 string quartets, the first one I wrote at the age of 11. Well, I didn't know Boulez. I was living in the Seattle area. And we had a very, in those days, it was quite a good school of music, and it was, for its time, considered, I think, one of the 10 best in the United States. But I don't think that, well, Schoenberg was known. I was aware of Schoenberg. But of the whole European group of people, Boulez, Stockhausen, Berlioz, none of that had penetrated at that time in the 1950s into America. There had been an embargo, not only from the critics in New York, for example, the very conservative people like Winthrop Sargent, but also the composers there, even people like Milton Babbitt and so on, who seemed to be very skeptical of the whole European movement. When Millau got me a French government scholarship to go to the Paris Conservatoire, I went to the wonderful theater where he was then the head of the theater score, and he also opened up a whole concert series called Domaine Musical, and it was an ensemble. As a matter of fact, I played piano there in the Domaine Musical when Berlioz was running it in Berlin in 1965. I'm talking now about 1957. At that point, I come to... And no, I'm sorry, 1959. 57 is when I was here to study with Darius Milhaud. And Aspen was a very different place then. You couldn't drink the water. The sewer and the water systems were all mixed up. All the roads were still dirt. There were very few restaurants. We had to eat at a kind of cafeteria called the Roaring Fork downtown. And it was a very different kind of place. The old miners' cottages were a bit run down, but they put pianos in the front rooms of as many as they could. And, it was a wild place in those days, and it was quite wonderful, but it's a very different feeling. Now you can barely recognize the Aspen that I knew back 1957. My Lord, that's a whole eon away. But back to Paris. I am going to the concert, the first Domaine Musical in which Pierre Boulez is listed as the conductor. He had been covering for a Swiss conductor named Hans Rosbaud, who was well known for new music, and Rosbaud was increasingly becoming too ill to be able to do the concerts. In fact, he would die the following January. But I remember being there. Berlioz had a piece called Alleluia 2 for 3 orchestras. There was several other pieces. I think there was a piece by Boulez, possibly, and a couple of other pieces of the very newest Boulez, Stockhausen, and Berlioz atmosphere of that particular time. And I was absolutely bowled over. I had never heard music like that. And I was very influenced by Boulez, and I was very influenced by Stockhausen, and very much, but even more by Berlioz, whom I really became close friends with. But I never was a 12-tonist. I used 12-tone once in a while. I was not a serialist. I was interested in the total chromatic. I would use it sometimes, just like a person would use fugues sometimes. You know, Bach wrote other things besides fugues. But there are pieces I've done that use 12-tone. Sometimes they use it in a kind of a satirical way. It did, particularly at that time. Sometimes they use it as an organizing principle for a larger piece. But I don't follow by tick, 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 this way, where in the backwards and all the classical things that people who were really purists would do. And I never was quite a 12-tonist as such. But it was a total chromatic music because I got it in my ear and I began to be interested in the language possibilities of an extended chromatic style. So that's what I was writing those years.
Well, how would you describe your growing use, or I might say infiltration, of other kinds of music, never losing that tremendous craft and sense of form, but having ragtime, having cabaret, having jazz, having Broadway, Tin Pan Alley?
Well, I tell you, the one thing that really struck me, especially when I came back to America, I realized that in New York, nobody played Boulez, Stockhausen, or Berlioz. They just didn't. I had a scholarship, which actually, thankfully, got me out of the Vietnam War. I did not make an effort to do that. I think, actually, I was saved from the war, very likely, by Darius Milhaud. One of his students was teaching at Stanford, Leland Smith, who's probably most remembered for inventing the first really good music software score. But he also was a composer and had studied with Milhaud. And so Milhaud, I'm sure, got a hold of Smith and said, please, I don't want to have this happen. I had to leave the conservatoire in early 1961 because the draft had called me. I got a little letter, some of you might remember, the same one from the president that said, greeting. Always in, I don't know why it was always in singing. Greeting. you better get your ass over here to this place. You're inducted. Well, not exactly the same, but that's exactly what it was. So I had to go to a place off the Champs-Élysées. And since I could get there on my own power, unfortunately, I was drafted. And they said, you can go back to the States and join their reserves, because then you don't have to go fight. In those days, before George W., the reserves were not called on to go fight wars. I really did not want to fight that war. In my state, you couldn't become a conscientious objector unless you'd been a Jehovah's Witness for 4 years. And no, I wasn't. So I was back to New York. I met the fellow who would be my librettist for 45 years, Arnold Weinstein. I worked on actually what had happened is Mio had gone to see his friend Daniel, who was one of my very closest friends. He died a couple of years ago, and wonderful artist, sculptor. And he and Arnold Weinstein were very close friends. Arnold was there, as it turned out, on the second year of a Fulbright. He was a Rhodes Scholar, which I didn't find out until he died. His niece helped write the obit in the New York Times. And anyway, so he gave the libretto to Mio, Arnold did. He brought it back to Paris after he'd seen Daniel down in Florence. Gave it to me. He says, I think this is just too American for me. What do you think of it? I took it home. I said, I want to do it. So he wrote Arnold. And February, after I'd actually done a kind of first draft of what would turn out to be a show called A Dynamite Tonight, an opera for actors, using actors, not singers, at that particular point, because singers were really very hard put to sing an understandable English. They were still trying to antagonize the vowels and to Britishize the consonants, which came out of about as understandable as Esperanto. So I had to turn to actors, and actors actually were very apt. They didn't necessarily read music well, but they were very quick studies. As Arnold said, they would hang the notes on the words, and I could throw anything at them as long as they learned it, and they learned it, you know, very well. So that was our first collaboration. Anyway, so there I was waiting for the axe to fall, and I got a call from Stanford University saying, we will offer you a deferment and a doctorate. So I went there for 3 years.
Great, but go back to cabaret, ragtime, rhythm and blues.
Oh, you want to know how I got into that other thing. Well, at some point in those years, when I was first there in the early 60s, I realized that we needed to have some place to play Boulez, Stockhausen, Berio. It was important that Americans get to know this work. And that particular point, it was only really done often either in San Francisco or Los Angeles. I premiered the published movements of Boulez's Third Sonata at that point in 1962 or something like that, and for America, and the in Los Angeles, the late pianist Leonard Stein did it a few weeks away from me. And those were among the first things. I think I premiered Stockhausen Contrapunta. And at that particular point, finally this music was filtering into New York. And, of course, what really made the difference was when Boulez went to the New York Philharmonic. All the composers went, will you please do my piece, you know. And so things were a little different after that. But meantime, I was beginning to find the limits of the enforced total chromatic. And I always somehow was a rebel anyway. I never believed that we had to do the same thing that I think many people felt from Europe. There was a feeling in those days that romantic music and the history of music in general, even tonality, was somehow to blame for the things that people did during the Second World War. In French, they would call it les grandes nuits européennes, the great European nights, in which the terrible things that happened. And people began to blame Wagner, which you can understand, of course, is anti-Semitism, but also the whole kind of history. They wanted to have a deracinated, unhistorical music. So they turned to Anton Webern, which, as far as I'm concerned, is a total misunderstanding of Webern. If Schoenberg is a distillation, I say wine, he made wine, maybe, and Webern made cognac out of the Viennese school. Webern is a kind of an encapsulated, very distilled version, I think, of much of the European, especially Viennese style. And I've always had a feeling that the Opus 20 symphony is really in D major and is very much of a gloss on the first movement of Mahler Ninth, which all the Schoenberg people, including Schoenberg and Berg and Webern, admired tremendously because they felt he was really an avatar. So anyway, the whole point was the post-Webern school was the idea of starting all over again, denying history, or as famous song by Edith Piaf said, "Je repars à zéro," starting all over from zero. And that was very much the feeling at the time. But it was certainly understandable in Europe, because I think people were unable really to touch whatever part of themselves, you still have trouble with that, that ever made them do the terrible things that were happening in Germany and elsewhere too. It's not the only place where people were not well behaving. Just in recent years, the French are beginning to realize that they have to face what they've done, and other people too. But this is something that is very hard for people to do, so the easiest way for them to feel about it was to try to deny history and start over. I never had that feeling. And even in those years I was writing total chromatic music, I used to sneak in, you know, triads. That was anathema. If you look at Poulet's book, what I think is very hard to read because it's extremely strange, cryptic French, called Pensée la musique aujourd'hui, and he talks about classed chords, i.e. triads, dominant seventh, even octaves, were prohibited because they would recall tonality. And the funny part about it is that people who are really good musicians, as Boulez was, familiar.
Sorry.
That's all right. I know that tune very well.
It's triadic.
Yeah. That poor woman who was listening to Mahler's Ninth, and right in the middle of the most heart-wrenching passage in the last movement, that person that just bought a cell phone and didn't know how to sell it, it'll set it off. And it became a pariah. I felt terrible for that person. But anyway, so I began to feel this is really limiting. I didn't have any need to destroy the tonality. I didn't have to deny history. I didn't have that same pressure. I grew up in the States, and we were sort of unaware of much of what had happened. And I don't think that we felt that we were at fault. In any event, I didn't need to try to deny the past. I had already begun to look at all of this total chromatic as a possible expansion of musical language. The difference between language spoken and written and musical language is that you expand language to be able to deal with what the language would mean. What's the word for chair in this language and that chair, so on. But you have an objective thing. Musical language, historically, in the last 1,000 or so years, has been a matter of people inventing the language, and then later, after a period of kind of accretion and sort of salting down and looking at the whole thing, there are certain things that get discarded, and over a while, that the new bits of language that were discovered by this process, Ars Antiqua going to Ars Nova is a famous case of that, in which Ars Nova sounds like music and Ars Antiqua doesn't. And it goes on like that. We've always had that process coming in. And then the idea is, unlike spoken or written language of words, the language is there, and then you find out what it means. And I think what happened after I had been aware of the wider possibility of the total chromatic is that I spent the rest of my time exploring what this new vocabulary meant without ever really quite discarding tonality in any kind of way. My Fantasy Sonata, which dated from 1961, which is full of influences of Boulez and Ives, I realize it's just been recorded by Christopher Taylor. There will be sometime these next year or so, three volumes of whatever piano music wasn't already available on disc. And so here I am looking at my Fantasy Sonata for the first time, like, 1961, how many years ago is that? And I suddenly realized, underneath it all, that's really in G major. The Hopi's really in G major. I didn't know it then. And so it's just like, I think what happened is I began to get very interested in very simple things. I think I actually date my finding ragtime from a name you probably remember, Alan News. He's a wonderful man named Norman Lloyd.
Oh, yeah.
And Norman, of course, we became very good friends. He was, for at different times, the Ford Foundation and Rockefeller. And he was a man who decided what money went for this or that musical institution. And we would have lunch. He would lament the fact that, oh, I'm giving money to these symphony orchestras and they're going to play the same old, and I feel kind of unhappy, but I guess I have to do it. And one day we're having lunch. I had done this two operas for actors. The first one was called Dynamite Tonight, and the other one, which is much more disorganized, but actually may have been more of a review, called Great Shot. And Norman had gone to it. I think I felt that it had not worked as a piece. I withdrew it, although we saved some of the numbers out of it. And he said, well, you know, do you know about the composer Scott Joplin? We're talking about 1967. Nobody in the classic world knew about the name Scott Joplin. They said, who was that? I think it's a name I've heard of. Oh, yeah, well, you know, he wrote the Maple Leaf Rag. Ah. He also wrote an opera in ragtime called Tremonition. I said, you know, I'm going to follow this up. It's sort of interesting to me. I looked around to try to find a score of Tremonition. There was not one in the Library of Congress. I called over to friends. They said, everybody I talked to, the County Cullen Library in northern, up in Harlem, and the Museum of the City in New York, the Lincoln Center Library, they all told me, actually, the Library of Congress had a card for it, but no score. And they all said, if you ever find us, let us know. And I was at that point teaching at Queens College. I had a drawer to myself. There were 10 people with 3 desks, and I came in and ran like everybody else at that point. I did my, the teaching I had to do, including music appreciation, which was torturous, and things like that. And I would zip in and zip out. And there was a fellow named Rudy Blesch who was teaching the jazz course, where there were like 500 people there, and he would play music or do film clips and so on. At the end, there was multiple choice. Billie Holiday was A, pitcher for the Birmingham Black Barons. B, a singer. C, you know, that kind of thing. And that was the extent of what he had to do. And you could see he came in and did his job and got paid and got out of it, as I did. After a month of fruitless searching, I asked Mr. Blesch, I didn't know him, do you know where I can find a score of Tremonition? He says, I have one at home. The next week he brought me this. It was reproduced by a group called the Ragtime Society out of Toronto. And up there was a man named John Arpin, who had become a very good pianist, and was a fine pianist, died very young. And he was doing recordings of Scott Joplin, and Sam and his wife were doing, Sam Charters was also doing recording. I somehow felt liberated. It was in a key. It had very square phrasing. It had a direct charm. And I'd always been interested in popular music, and I couldn't necessarily... I couldn't eschew it, although I certainly was conflicted for a number of years. Probably, I don't know if we have time for this, but I'll talk about how I began to have some problems with it. Because I was writing Dynamite Tonight, which was actually nothing to do with 12-tone, except for the fact that the prisoner, there was supposed to be a war, endless war, and the prisoner, who had been captured by the side that was, so to speak, our side, and he sang in 12-tone because he was so foreign. But otherwise, it was like First World War music, and that's exactly what. But I could. People say, "Well, you have to decide: are you going to be that kind of composer, or are you going to be a person involved with total chromatic?" And I was being very conflicted. For 1 year in 1965 to 66, I taught back at the University of Washington, which I'd done one day a week as a boy from the age of 11, because I lived nearby there, and I studied with the heads of the composition and the piano department, and. Anyway, I just went back again later years, and it was a very different matter. But I was talking about having felt that I was really very conflicted. John Cage would come out. Now, John Cage had taught at the Cornish School not far from there in Seattle and was sort of, he eloped. Left his ballerina wife and went off with Bruce Cunningham, which is, of course, one of the great partnerships of the history. And... anyway, we were asked by the local Pacifica station to talk. We talked for 3 hours. And I remember going out, and a very conservative person on the faculty at the University of Washington said, now you go out there and demolish him. And I said, well, and so I got to John Cage, and I said, I'm supposed to demolish you. Well, then when I was a little boy, I was 12 and 13, 14, John Cage would come, and he would do his demonstration of what he was doing at the university, and people would very ceremoniously walk out. I was often the last person. You have to imagine this little fat kid sitting there being the last person. I just was fascinated by him. I fascinated by his attitude. I fascinated by his open attitude about what music was and so on. So we talked for 3 hours. And he said something in the middle of the third hour. He asked me, well, how are you as a composer? Where are you? And I said, I'm very conflicted. I have this problem about... the total chromatic on one hand, and also my interest in vernacular music, which is a nasty word. I don't know what I said then. And he said something that opened my eyes. Tim Page, who was working on a while on a John Cage biography, he said that many composers had said that Cage had said something to them that opened their eyes. Cage said to me, "Some people divide the world into something that is good and something that is bad. Other people take it all in and let their inner organism decide." And that absolutely opened my eyes. I suddenly realized it was all right to have this conflict in there. It was all right to absorb the boast. And then when I suddenly realized, then it got to be interesting. I said, how do I relate the most very avant-garde style I had been practicing with my interest in things like Dynamite Tonight and my interest in things that you'll also see when you, if you come to the wedding. And I finally realized it was a question of me finding out how they all related in a larger expanse of what kind of way. And I have to credit that to Cage saying that very important thing to me, and that I should let my inner organism decide rather than making an a priori decision. And I have to thank him for that.
Oh, that's a fantastic story.
Long answer to a short question.
No, but I might want to take a pause, only because you've been using the term so much, to say something, and then you can judge me about total chromatic, because all 12-tone music employs the total chromatic, but not all total chromatic music is 12-tone, and most 12-tone music is serial, but not all serial music is 12-tone. So, 12-tone music, it takes the 12 pitches in Western tuning and puts them into a particular order, which then helps generate the musical texture. Total chromatic just means you're very concerned with using all of the 12 pitches, not necessarily in what order or how. So there's a very important music by Bach, which is clearly employing a total chromatic orientation.
Yeah, I was that rather than a serial composer. As I said, I sometimes use serial, sometimes for a joke. But no, I didn't ever feel that I was going to be bound to any of those things. And I couldn't help it. I mean, even my interest in continuing with some kind of tonal reference, even the most complex music, was something I really couldn't help, just as I couldn't help making The Shepherd and the Songs of Innocence of the Country and Western. In other words, I was drawn to it.
Well, let's switch gears, and we're just going to jump forward a number of years, but to one of your great cabaret songs. You have, I think, at least 4 volumes of cabaret songs. And virtually every American singer that I know sings them. We have just recently, in the past few years, had Nathan Gunn, Sasha Cooke, Debbie Voigt, everybody sings the cabaret songs. But I thought we would listen to one, just so that the audience and the radio audience who will hear this later would get a sense of that aspect of your work. So the one we've chosen is called Black Max. I think this predates the Mad Max movies and should not be confused with them.
My last opera for actors is called Casino Paradise. And everybody said, oh, yes, I loved your Cinema Paradiso or Casino Royale. And that's what happened, I think, with Mad Max and Black Max.
Yep. Okay. So do you want to say anything about it, or should we just hear it?
No, I probably should tell you the background. When I got to New York from Paris in about February of 61, I had a rough crossing. In those days, it was cheaper to take a boat than a plane. And I arrived not knowing what I was going to be doing, just a little money in my pocket. And I was met by a man named John Gruen, who just recently died. He was a composer and a kind of a Renaissance man who was actually, in those days, doing critiquing for the Herald Tribune. Virgil Thompson had a whole kind of a stable of composers writing up reviews, including him, Francis Thorne, and some other. And John Gruen said, "There's a party in your honor." I'm just this kid from, like, I was 21, 22, and I just landing into Paris, I mean from Paris to New York, I was taken to this party that was on 57th Street when people had lofts between 6th and 7th Avenues, upstairs over all the shops. And I would end up staying there waiting for the moment that the draft would call me. But there was this party. Who was there? All the most important painters of the New York School, de Kooning and Larry Rivers, who became a friend, and several other people, too, Jane Freilicher, who recently died, John Button, the whole numbers of these fantastic painters, other people less known like Howard Karamovitz, and also Edward Albee was there, Orton Feldman was there, John Ashbery was there, and mostly Frank O'Hara, who was a kind of a den mother for this whole group of people, which was very cohesive. He was then an assistant curator at the Museum of Modern Art, and he would call us all on the phone before something happening in the next night or even that night. He said, there's a poetry reading at such and such a place, you come. And we would all show up. Or there was a gallery opening, or the night before, that's what Frank was able to do at MoMA, for example. He would get us to come and see the paintings before they were open to the public, and we could look at them the evening before, all hung and all ready to be looked at. And I remember even doing that. Joan and I did a concert at MoMA so many years ago, and they were showing the new maximalist Frank Stella, and it was going to be open the next night. So they let us go and take a look, and it brought me back to those times in 1961 where I had gone to see those things as they opened up at the Museum of Modern Art and all these other things. So there was this very tight cadre of the most important artists of New York at that time who was so cohesive, and they're all great friends. Unfortunately, probably what happened is some made a lot of money and others didn't, and that sort of broke up the gang. But basically, I couldn't get over that whole feeling, and it was really a big, amazing change for me. And I began to realize that I really had to follow my own instincts, whether I knew where I was going or not. So this is probably, if you want to look at the whole history of what brought me to where I am right now stylistically, I was dragged into it.
Okay, so this is Black Max.
Yeah, I forgot to tell you the background of that. I'm sorry, I really am so circular. I'm sorry, this poor man had no warning of the kind of circular person I am. Used to drive my students nuts, but they were always glad that I came out. I was somehow came back to where I started. Okay, the point was this. Arnold had gone to see Bill de Kooning, and de Kooning's brother had come to see him. They had not seen each other for 30 years. And they started talking to Arnold in English, which is easy for Dutch people, about what it was like to be in Rotterdam before the war. And he talked about the people there, the street people, the whole kind of interesting. There are early drawings by Willem de Kooning of these little streets, the Gassen and all the rest. And there was one character on the street named Svelte the Max, or Black Max. And he never said anything. He would raise his hat and lower it. And that was all he did. He was a very mysterious character. And they described it. And Arnold wrote out the description. And that is the text of Black Max.
He was always dressed in black. Long black jacket, broad black hat. Sometimes a cape. On the train one day far away to the good old USA. When I heard the music underneath the track, standing there beneath the bridge, long black jacket, broad black hat, playing the harmonica one hand free, to lift that hat to me.
So that is Joan Morris and William Volcom. The rhythm is so seductive and perfect.
That was actually at the Flea Theater, which was, of course, put together by Stephanie. I'm sorry. She played that woman in The Alien, a very famous actress. What? Sigourney Weaver and her husband Jim Bishop, Jim Simpson, who I think they just relinquished the Fleet Theater, but it was there. There was a cabaret performance, and we did those in 2003. So that's from that time.
Oh. So I want to jump into A Wedding, the opera that we're hearing this week, and throw just a couple of things at you. It's based, of course, on the Robert Altman film, and Robert Altman participated in the libretto. It has an extraordinary number of characters, and each character is characterized uniquely through the music. And so there are many styles, many forms of music happening. It's something that Joan Morris is celebrated for, is inhabiting a song, creating a whole world out of a song. And I think in your opera, you do that for every single character. And yet they all have to be on stage at once, and the orchestra has to pull them all together somehow.
Well, I've always felt that everybody has some tune in them. And, you know, there's many cases in popular music where a person has written one wonderful song, and that was their song. But composers just simply seem to have the nerve to write more than one song. That's why we, you know, sometimes everything they do is not of equal quality. And I have to say it's true of my case. But you know, it's just something I felt that, you know, what I try to do in my setting for any time I have somebody singing is that I wanted to have this, what they're singing, be part of what their inner musical life may have been. And so I've tried somehow to find a way to, that's the main thing that made me, that impelled me to write words of music. I also had the great advantage when I was at the University of Washington as an undergraduate in 55 through 58, studying with the great poet Theodore Retke, who is probably one of the most musical of poets. I mean, Ned Roram has said so much of it, and I've said a good deal myself. And somehow he was a wonderful training. I went into his class. In that class was a wonderful poet who just died a few years later, James Wright, quite well-known poet. And he was in my class. He was already published, but he wanted to sit at the feet of the master. And Retke had brought a whole bunch of very important poets to be there and around. So I was I was an English minor. I was able to take any course I wanted because I tested out of any kind of requirements so I could do anything I want. And so I studied a whole year with Retke. And I told him I don't want to become a poet, although I did write some things that might pass for a poem when I was there. And he was quite understanding. I said I wanted to find out how to write poetry so that when I said it, I would be able to do so with the willingness to understand something that if you went to an introduction to poetry, they talk about it with what it means. And what I was more interested in to find out what the poet, you know, what a poem is. It's, you know, vowels and consonants, how it put together, how they deal with the stresses and so on. And I felt that was the best way to learn it.
Fantastic. So, by the way, is your new opera, Dinner at Eight, based on the film?
Yes, it's the only opera I know of that's been based on the film that I did. I did the first one, actually, was McTeague, which I'm glad to say was revived after 20 years of not being done, at Linz, again with Dennis Russell Davies, who has premiered so many of my important things. He premiered all my operas at Lyric Opera Chicago. He's still there at Linz. I think he's in the process of becoming a laureate, more or less retiring. He's a bit younger than I am, but not that much. Anyway, so all those poems were, the first ones came not from the movie Greed, but that's really what inspired me to look at McTeague, because the girl I was going with at the time when I was at Stanford doing this improvised silent movie accompaniments told me, you better read the novel too. So I did read it. And when they were asking me for an opera, what happens is that Artis Krenik, who is this amazing woman that nobody I've ever known has come close to her marvelous spirit. And she said, let's find a good thing for you to set. And Andrew Greeley, whom I knew slightly, a very charming person, you know, who was the head of the largest parish in the world, that's in Chicago. And he also wrote these sexy novels with, you know, you used to see them with the boss covers with women with the cleavage of a cross in them. And but a very charming and fun person. And he finally said, why doesn't Bill do this pit by Frank Norris, who's a very important Chicago writer? And I looked at it and I said, no, but you know what? I think I'd like to look into McTeague again. I turned to Bob Altman because I had seen a production he had done. Actually, we did it at the University of Michigan when I was there, because he was able to do what he wanted there, A Rake's Progress. And I've always had a problem with that piece. And it's likely, largely because of, I think, the problem that I've always had with a libretto. I don't think it's the best of Auden, and I have a suspicion a great deal of it, more than we'll ever find out, was really by Chester Cullman, his partner. And that would also happen with an opera by Hans Werner Henze, Elegy for Young Lovers. And I had a problem with it because it did seem like it was, there's a lot of archness in it, and that really still bothered me. And Bob did a wonderful thing. In the opera, the last movement, the last scene is really Tom Rakewell in the insane asylum. And Bob had this wonderful idea. The whole opera takes place in an insane asylum. And I thought that was absolutely groundbreaking and made all of the problems I'd ever felt with that piece somehow palatable, because everybody was. It was in a strange kind of state. They were all nuts. And it made a wonderful way to do it, and I hope that some opera director will have the good smarts to try the same idea, because I was just talking with another director yesterday, that night, and the same thing is he'd had exactly the same problems with A Rake's Progress, and maybe he'll do it that way. Anyway, so I was so impressed by him, and I'd loved his films anyway, that I asked him to be the director. And I remember going to Artis Krenik. She said, well, who would you like to have direct? And I said, Robert Altman. And she said, who's that? It goes to show you how hermetically sealed all these fields are. People in opera don't know anything else. People in film don't know anything else. People in theater don't know anything else. It's people in classical music don't know the other thing, and vice versa, except for the young, who seem to be able to do Beethoven during the day and listen to Nine Inch Nails at night, and find no conflict in that, which I think makes it very interesting. You can call upon a whole great wide variety of things. When we were casting, the thing that I find very amusing, Mark Delavan, who comes from the South, and you'll hear, if you come to it, this kind of Elvis number called It's When Snooks Suddenly Finds the Light and Decides He Has to Become a Christian. I was so delighted to find Marcus from the South, and he was able immediately to relate to that whole style. And I could find that was true with pretty much everybody. They're all finding ways to be able to do with their background and how that could somehow feed into the character.
Great. You know, we have only a few minutes left, and I would feel sad if I didn't give you a chance to ask Bill a question.
You used the term dramatic, and I've... for myself, use the term atonal.
Atonal?
Yes. What's the difference? Deal?
Well, the idea of atonality is that it has nothing to do with the key. And that's a different matter from chromatic. Although chromatic can obfuscate the key, I've always had a feeling you could take Schoenberg and find a harmonic analysis underneath it that would actually be a classic tonal analysis. And if you play Schoenberg, you have to mark the cadences just as if it were Brahms. And then it makes sense. And otherwise, it doesn't. I've seen the same thing happening. My friend Sergio Luca, the late violinist, was playing a concert involving the Fantasy for Violin and Piano in a group of Brahms pieces, and it absolutely went over the audience the same way as Brahms, because it was played with the understanding of the tonal references that Schoenberg never really tried to get rid of. He was not interested in trying to get rid of tonality. He didn't have that process. He was trying to merge all tonalities. He used a rather mechanistic way of doing it, which I felt almost is a little bit old-fashioned, particularly after Einstein had dealt with relativity. And that's actually, I think that's what I look at myself as a person who's more involved with the relativity part about it. This is not to denigrate Schoenberg, because if you play with Schoenberg with understanding, you can follow it just like any other music. But you have to play it with that understanding. And that's the difference between atonality, which I think is actually a misnomer. It's just because sometimes the tonalities that are implied go by so quickly, you can't follow them.
Could you comment on Kurt Weill and his experience in Berlin and any influence it had for you?
Well, I do know that he had studied with Busoni, who was very angry at him for going to the popular music he had gotten involved with. And I remember that Arnold Weinstein and I both knew the Kurt Weill, Bertolt Brecht stuff quite well. In fact, Arnold did a very fine translation of Mahagoni, which I have to say is supplanted by another friend of mine's translation, which is now the standard one. But I hate to say that, I still prefer Arnold's. I remember in college, I studied and looked at seriously at Kurt Weill, and I realized, first of all, it was much more German than I could ever be, but I could also see he was, if you looked at some of the music that was around that time, other composers who were interested in popular music, old people like Friedrich Holländer, and so on, you realize that he was part of a style that was common at the time. What they considered with jazz was essentially dotted eighths and sixteenths, all over the place, and it was known in that time as yachts. But it really would be Taligiati United States before he became kind of, in fact, I've talked to musicologists from Germany who actually prefer his music he wrote since moving here in 1933 to the other, because they knew the other material. And Kurt Weill is, as I say, one of the stylists. The difference, I think, was that Bertolt Brecht's words were such a very strong style of their own. Although we know how eclectic he was, he also, there are whole lots of sections at which he would not only ask for contributions, he had a long table, anybody wanted to write something, but also Elizabeth Hauptmann, who's very important, who probably wrote most of Happy End, for example, which is sort of by a Johnny came from, and things like that. But no, he had a very strong influence on me, but I did not want to sound German. Neither one of us did. So the cabaret songs, we did all we could do to stay away from the feeling of Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht. They're not very much of that feeling, because we wanted to be our own. We didn't want to come out and sound like a kind of an offshoot of that style, in which we had to kind of get rid of the Germish kind of sound.
When you're deciding what sort of work to make into an opera, what do you look for? What are the characteristics?
I have to be attracted to it. And I don't think there's any rule about that, but I do know that in the case of Dynamite Tonight, that was because I had Arnold, who worked with me, and I was very attracted to that particular thing. Arnold was an extremely widely educated person who at the same time was trying to involve vernacular styles as part of his kit bag. And I had the same kind of attitude, and so we got along extremely well. In the case of McTeague, it's because I was attracted to the possibility. Even when I was improvising a score for Greed, I said, gosh, this would be a great opera someday. And that was 1962. And when artists asked me eventually what I wanted to do, I said, well, you know, I think I'd like to look at McTeague again, and I did. And I brought it to both Bob and to Arnold Weinstein, and they both were excited about the idea, and that's how we did that case. But we actually took it from the novel. A View from the Bridge was a matter of the fact that Arnold would often be called in by Arthur Miller, who during his lifetime was besieged by people who had come in and sent him a whole first act of somebody had set one of his plays, like Death of a Salesman or something. And Arnold, who Arthur thought that he was very knowledgeable about librettos, so they'd had to look at both, and they both looked at what the thing was like, if there was any kind of a tape and so on. And he usually nixed pretty much every try of operas that he could. He was ambivalent about Bob Ward's The Crucible, which is still quite often done, because Arthur felt it was too close to the play. So, and the reason is not strange, but I think Arthur, as was Arnold, was an extremely widely cultured person with a very Catholic, with a small C attitude about the whole thing. He was a marvelous collaborator. We settled on A View from the Bridge because finally, after looking to one other failed person who had actually written a whole first act, and then Arthur shoots it down. That must have been very sad for the composer. Any learning experience of the kind. What they usually did was try to set every word. If you said every word in a Broadway play, it will go on for 5 hours. It'll be like Parsifal. So you really can't do that. So the idea was to try to make it the same length as the Broadway play, which meant very careful cutting. And you really have to do that and be able to do that very carefully. Arthur was the most marvelous. He was actually much more draconian than either one of us dared to be as to what to cut out. But he also knew what to insist on keeping. And it was a terrific, wonderful collaboration there. That's the second one, which came from a play. Now, Bob used to tell me that even way back when I was working on McTeague, that I had told him that I'd like to make an opera out of a wedding. And he said, forget it, I'll never be able to get the rights back. He had had a big success with the movie Nashville. How many of you have seen that? You may? Oh, a lot of you have. Okay. It's something that's worth reviving again. I think a lot of younger people have never seen it. And it was a great success. Well, the wedding they had had 24 characters for Nashville, and they decided to double it to make 48 characters. So they burdened themselves with a whole notion, which is kind of a problem. There's an excellent piece in that magazine you put out about the whole thing, quite accurate. And in there, it describes that I got to know John Considine, who was the main collaborator with Bob on the movie A Wedding. And he showed me the original script. All 48 characters had a little squib, about 3 or 4 lines, describing their secret. And that was very interesting to see. And then we had to take these 48 characters and boil them down to 16. And that was almost a year's effort between Bob and Arnold to work out what got to be conflated. Actually, the artist died before we ever could produce a wedding there. In fact, she also didn't make A View from the Bridge. She died before it was opening, which is very sad. Anyway, but Bill Mason, who was taking over for her, he actually had a very good idea. He said, let's take Howard Duff's character, who was a drunken doctor and kind of an old stage actor in New York, who was also in Bob's movie called Pat McCormick, and conflate their two people. Pat was supposed to be an art dealer who falls in love with Tulip in a movie she's played by Carol Burnett. And so he had the idea, let's put together the drunken doctor and the art dealer. And Arnold and I said, yeah, because we both knew guys who were very important art dealers who had started out as doctors. The reason was because they knew starving artists who couldn't pay for their medical treatment, so they paid in their paintings. Well, some of them became quite famous artists. And so you were given this whole collection of tremendously popular and possibly lucrative, paintings. And several people quit doctoring and they became dealers. And there's an aria in the opera called Pollock, de Kooning, and Klein, having to do with the doctor explaining to Tulip why he quit medicine. And that's the whole idea, because this sort of thing happens. But a lot of people have been conflict. The whole idea of taking 48 characters and bringing them down to 16 was a terrific job, but they worked it out. And mostly it was really Arnold would end up working out and writing the words of the libretto, but Bob's biggest contribution was putting together what you do in movies called a scenario. Every scene is not necessarily all written out. A scenario is basically, this scene must accomplish plot point X. And that's the idea. Sometimes they are improvised. Actually, a very nice book by Dalton Trumbo, I think it's called Johnny Got Its Gun, explains, if you ever have a chance to look at it, how movies often were like that. That scenarios, and there's not necessarily a full script. You'll turn to your actors and you'll ask them to improvise. Now, Bob, who had some connection with improvisation theater, so did I. I worked with Paul Sills, who founded Second City. And I even improvised with the group of them in New York while I was waiting for the draft. And then I worked with them through August before I went out to 1961 to Stanford. So I did quite a bit of improvising with the likes of Barbara Harris, who was going with Arnold at the time, Alan Alda. If you see that movie, Paul Dooley was in our group. And many wonderful people, Zora Lampert and Severn Darden, all great people in the very first 1950s and 60s incarnation of Second City, which, as you know, came out from Chicago. And so he was quite used to improvisation. I had also done it. And so we found that we had a lot of friends in common. It was a very wonderful collaboration. And I have to say, I'm so thankful for all my very most important collaborators. Arnold Weinstein, I worked with him 45 years. Bob Altman on both McTeague and A Wedding. And Arthur Miller. They're all gone now. I have to sort of make the decisions all by myself.
Well, our hour has passed. Do come to A Wedding. It's tomorrow, Thursday, July 28th at the Wheeler Opera House, and then again Saturday, July 30.
I'll tell you one thing. It's a fantastic performance. Don't miss it.